nice to see you.
Well, thank you so very much. It is an incredible joy and honor, a privilege to be with all of you this evening. I'm very honored at the opportunity to speak with all of you and hopefully to get to meet some of you before this evening is finished. There is a joke that makes its rounds, and it's, you know, what do you call a person who's, well, what do you call a person who speaks three languages? You know, somebody who's trilingual. What do you call someone who speaks two languages? Bilingual. What do you call a person who speaks one language?
American.
An American, that's right. And unfortunately, I fit into that category. I've gotten my feet wet with German and with Hebrew, but not in a conversational way. But it, again, it is a real joy to be with all of you this evening. As it was said, I am a Messianic Jew. I came to believe in Jesus back in 1974, long before many of you were even born. Today, I have a congregation in Buffalo, New York, that is called Congregation Brit Chadashah. Brit Chadashah, it's Hebrew, and it means New Covenant. So we are the congregation of the New Covenant. The makeup of our congregation is Jewish, and it's also, there are many non-Jewish people who are members of our congregation. And we look at what we do as just being prophetic. The prophet Isaiah foretold of a time when my house shall be a house of prayer for all peoples. When I consider the Abrahamic blessing, the promise that was given to Abraham was that through you and your seed, all of the families of the earth would be blessed. When I look at all of your faces, I can tell you that each and every one of you have been blessed because of that Abrahamic blessing. You have been blessed through that Abrahamic blessing, through your faith in Jesus the Messiah. My path to faith took on a very interesting way. I was challenged one day by a very devout Catholic friend of mine. It wasn't really a challenge, but she said something to me that I really did not understand. She said to me, "I wish I could have been born Jewish." And I said to her, "I don't understand. You are very sound in your faith." She proceeded then to tell me that Jesus was Jewish, that the Bible was written by Jewish people, and that many of the events of the Bible take place in the land of Israel. When she said that, she provoked me to jealousy. I wanted to know more about this person, Jesus. Growing up in a Jewish home, everything that we understood about Jesus was never anything good. So I was challenged. I was challenged even more when she asked me questions regarding Moses and the law. I knew nothing. As a Jewish man, my father is a survivor of the Holocaust from the Debrecen, Hungary. And my mother and her family, they were driven out of their home in Poland or Ukraine. The borders changed, and they made their way to America. So me believing in Jesus was something that was not met with a lot of joy by my parents and by my family. Today, my congregation, we have been in the city of Buffalo for a long, long time. We have enjoyed the friendships of many people all throughout the community, both Catholic and Protestant. I want to set a little scene for all of you. A couple weeks ago, I was with a friend of mine, an elderly man. For 60 years, he has served as a missionary to the islands of the South Pacific. particularly the islands of Papua New Guinea. For many, many years, for four decades, he has served with Wycliffe Bible translators, putting the Bible into the language of the over 800 tribes of Papua New Guinea. And he made a point that when he first started to speak to these people, they knew nothing about any kind of outside religion, be it Catholic, Protestant, or Jewish. And so consider this. What if there was this remote desert island, and no one on that island ever heard of the Bible, never heard of anything Jewish, never heard anything about Jesus? And then a day came where a plane dropped off, and they began to read that Bible without any previous understanding of the Bible. Consider them reading that for the first time. How would their worship look? Would it look Jewish? Would it look Christian? Would they observe things that were more geared towards the Jewish faith? Would they consider, or would they worship more things considering, you know, the Christian faith? For example, would Passover be a part of their celebration, or would it be Easter? Since they have no orientation, they would probably lean toward the things that are written in the law, written in the New Testament, regarding the life and times of Jesus the Messiah, seeing what he had done, seeing what he had worshipped. And so this is the context. When I came to faith, the very first time I read the New Testament, I was absolutely hooked on Matthew 1:1. Matthew 1:1, that very first sentence of the New Covenant. And it says simply, this is the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And I was enamored. I couldn't believe what I was reading. I couldn't believe that this is Jesus and this is his genealogy, that he is the son of David, that he is the son of Abraham. And immediately I began to think, if this is Jesus, then why doesn't the Jewish community recognize that he is a genuine Jewish personality? And I thought too, if this is Jesus, then why does Christianity look the way it does? Why do they hate us if this is Jesus? And that very same evening, because of what I read in Matthew 1:1, I read through the entirety of the Gospel of Matthew. I had never read anything of the New Testament. And so this was all fresh. It was all something new to me. But one thing stood out in my reading of Matthew. I was able to recognize a lot of the things that I was reading about, and I was able to identify this writing as Jewish. The Sermon on the Mount, well, these are some of the most lofty Jewish teachings, the proclamation of the kingdom of God. It is said in Jewish thought that a prayer is not a prayer unless there is the mention of the kingdom of God. And this is what I saw in the Sermon on the Mount. I read in Matthew 9, Jesus wearing tzitzit or fringes, the prayer shawl that you see many Orthodox men wearing, that Jesus wore these things, that Jesus attended even a celebration of Hanukkah at the temple in Jerusalem, and obviously Passover, because everybody here is familiar with the Last Supper. And so I was able to make these connections. and they made an impression on me. And as much as I wanted to dismiss these things that I am learning, understanding that if I really believe it, that it's going to cause me a lot of problems with my parents, with my family, and with the Jewish community. But yet the compelling truth was that Jesus is the Messiah. Now, our congregation back home, as I said, it's Congregation Brit Hadashah, Congregation of the New Covenant. There's something very, very interesting about the promise of the New Covenant. The Hebrew prophet Jeremiah, he had said, "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not like the covenant I made with their fathers when I took them by the hand and led them out of Egypt." And I recognize that this new covenant was a covenant that God had still made with the Jewish people. That it was part of that Abrahamic blessing to bring all of the families of the earth into the fold of God. That God was going to draw all people unto Him. And He would do that through the people of Abraham and his seed. Every one of you are a testimony, a living, breathing testimony of the power of God to salvation. Every one of you are a living, breathing testimony to the faithfulness of God in fulfilling that promise to Abraham that all of the nations of the earth would be blessed. The good news of God's Messiah has gone out through to the entire world. It is a message that will have no end. I consider the wonderful prophecy of Isaiah, a prophecy that you might see on many Christmas cards. "For a child will be born to us, and a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end." See, of the increase of God's government in Messiah and peace, there will be no end. In other words, this good news, this life-transforming power of the gospel will be reached throughout all of the world. And all of you are witnesses to that. Now this brings us round, to a full circle. When I look at all of the events of the first century and all of the followers of Jesus, unquestionably, when we look at the book of Acts, all of these followers of Jesus, they were Jewish people. They were Jewish people. When we read about Peter preaching at the temple, and on one day, 3,000 souls were added. 3,000 Jewish people believed a redemptive message. On the following day, Peter preached again, and there were 5,000 more that were added. We read Jerusalem being turned upside down because there were so many who believed in Jesus. Historians, Neander and others, estimate there to have been 1.5 million Jewish people who believed and followed Jesus. Many from the sect of the Pharisees. And this is all chronicled in the book of Acts. But I want to call your attention to something very dynamic that took place in the 15th chapter of the book of Acts. there was a problem that had arisen. There were many, many non-Jewish people who were coming to believe in Jesus. And so there was a debate. There was a debate. What do we do with so many non-Jewish people coming into the faith? Remember, the only orientation they had was Jewish. This was before there was anything known as Christianity. And the issue was, do we need to circumcise all of these people who were coming to faith? And the council at Jerusalem met with Peter and James and John and all of the leading apostles. And they agreed that we lay no further burden upon the Gentiles, that they need not be circumcised. You see, today we have, to use an English expression, we've come a full circle. Today the issue is, what do we do with many Jewish people who are coming to find for the first time that Jesus is the promised Messiah of Israel? My congregation is a small part of that, but I lead a wider group of American Jewish believers with the Messianic Jewish Alliance of America. And we are 168 congregations strong, and there are many other alliance congregations that meet worldwide. At the end of this week, many Messianic Jewish congregations and national alliances will be meeting in Berlin. And so there is a growing number of Jewish people coming to faith. And so now everything is reversed. Now the questions that are being asked is, you know, do Jewish believers now have to follow largely Christian traditions? The very same issues that the first non-Jewish believers faced in Jerusalem, now the pendulum has swung in the other direction. And so while individuals like me, we will never ever be a majority, like the Jewish people, we are a minority, even if every Jewish person on the face of this earth came to believe in Jesus, we would still be a minority. When I consider that Jewish people constitute 1/3 of 1% of the world's population, it's amazing to me that we are still around. When I consider all of the many hundreds of years where we have been persecuted before the Christian era and after, right up to this present time. You see, God is faithful to his covenant. God made a promise to Abraham that he is going to keep, that there will always be a Jewish presence on this earth. God promised through Abraham a land. And for nearly 2,000 years, we have been away from that land. Moreover, Jerusalem hasn't been in Jewish hands in nearly 2,500 years. But I have been alive long enough to witness and experience a miracle of history, that in 1948, God made good on the words that he gave to our prophets and the words that he gave to Abraham regarding a land. And he brought back Jewish people from all over the known world, to use a biblical term, from the four corners of the earth. And he brought us back to the land of Israel. This, my friends, is a miracle of history. No other people group has been dispersed and sent away for that long and returned to their ancestral homeland, still retaining a common language, a common prayer book, a common Bible, and everything coming together. And it didn't matter if they were from Syria or Japan or Argentina or America. They came and they were able to speak and pray in the same similar tongue, a revived tongue of Hebrew. And then in 1967, the miracle of the reunification of Jerusalem. Again, this is a miracle of history. Jesus, in his Olivet Discourse, he taught that you shall not see me again until you say, Baruch Haba B'Shem Adonai, which is Hebrew, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Well, we are living very close to the time, I believe, for Jesus' return. The Jewish people, we are back in our land. Jerusalem is in our hands again. How many know that Israel is a hotbed of a lot of political controversy all around the world? The prophet Zechariah said that Israel would be a cup of reeling, a stumbling stone to the nations. The nations, they do not know what to do with Israel. And so the Middle East is war-torn. In 2 more weeks, the United Nations is going to carry on a vote for the creation of another state called Palestine. And there is so much misinformation in media outlets all over the world that the term Palestinian is misunderstood. Historically, when an individual was referred to as a Palestinian, automatically you would think it's a Jewish person. That was the name of that land that was given by the Romans. When the Romans conquered the land, to add insult to injury, they renamed the land Palestina, naming it after Israel's longtime enemy, the Philistines. But Jewish people who lived in that land were always referred to as Palestinians. But in 1973, a man named Yasser Arafat created a whole new people group, and he referred to them as the Palestinians. So today, when we think Palestinian, we think somebody who is not Jewish, somebody who is Arabic. And rather than going into the political debates back and forth, the point of my going there is that we're living in a very important time of history where God is making good on the promise he made to our fathers, that he is going to restore faith to Israel, that he is going to restore faith to the sons of Abraham. I am but a small remnant of that promise, and there are growing numbers of individuals like myself. So when I have the opportunity to speak to all of you, to communicate to you something that maybe you have not heard of before, you know, I do so very delicately because it is difficult to hear something that maybe you have not heard before. This is why I gave the illustration of, you know, living on a remote desert island, never hearing anything at all about any kind of formal religion. See, this was my orientation. I had preconceived views regarding Christianity. I had preconceived views regarding the Jewish world. But when I looked at the text, I recognized it for what it was, that it is a genuine Jewish writing. And I tell you, I am honored to be living in this day. It is an exciting time. I am very thankful for all of you who are here and listening to this. And we are going to have a time for question and answer, teaching the scripture within a Jewish context is something that I've been doing now for nearly 35 years. This was not my training. I have no theological training. My education was in accounting, in business. And I owned and operated a business for nearly 17 years before going into the ministry that I now serve at. But I want to leave you with this. God is faithful. He is true to the covenants that he has made. When I consider the gospel, there has always been a biblical priority. Romans 1 and verse 16 inspired me in many ways. The Apostle Paul, St. Paul, says, "I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God to salvation to all who believe, to the Jew first, and also to the Gentile." Now, when the great apostle said this, I took great encouragement with the words, "I am not ashamed," because I heard a lot of negative communication from family members. "Shame on you," I would hear. "Shame on you. If your grandfather knew what you are doing, they would roll over in their graves." And I would hear this, but I would draw encouragement because I don't know how many of you knew, but St. Paul, he was a great rabbi, a great learned rabbi. According to the book of Acts, he studied at the feet of Rabbi Gamaliel, prominent personage of the Talmud. He studied under Gamaliel. He was a Pharisee of Pharisees by his own writings and descriptions. And so when he could say, "I am not ashamed," I was encouraged by thinking, "I also am not ashamed." And then he continues and he gives us the only definition of what the gospel is. We can think of many things of what the gospel is, but the great apostle defines it as the power of God to salvation for all who believe. And it is still today the power of God to salvation. I have seen lives transformed. Father, I know you have seen lives transformed. All of you, God is transforming your lives. And with the wonderful teachers, the faculty here, God is beginning to do something great and wonderful in all of you. But St. Paul also had a little order there. He said that this gospel should go to the Jew first and also to the Gentile. And in my teachings, and this is my emphasis, this is the priority that our congregation and congregations like mine have established, that we want to go to our people first, not at the expense of eliminating anybody. But I believe that the greatest way to touching the entire world and reaching the entire world with the good news of what Jesus has done for us is by going first to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Jesus' very first marching orders to the 12 were these: "Go not in the way of the Gentile and the Samaritan. Go first to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." This was also the message of St. Paul. This is the message that we carry, because we understand that even if we are a small minority, God is faithful that he will use that small minority to reaching every nation on this earth. And I want to leave you with a simple illustration, and I will close and we will open up for question and answer. I am from Buffalo, New York. If you live in America and you mention Buffalo, Americans think one thing: a lot of snow and cold. And I know it gets really cold here in Poland. Growing up, I was a member of the Boy Scouts of America. Are there Boy Scouts here in Poland? And we learned many things. We learned, first of all, how to make a fire if we were camping. There are laws that govern the universe. There are laws that also govern the spiritual domain. If I wanted to start a fire, how would I do it? If I had a log and a box of matches, and I asked Peter to come up and help me to light a fire, and I asked him to hold a log, and I strike a match, and I put it under the log, will that log ever catch fire? That log is not going to catch fire. What do I need to do? I have got to start with something smaller, don't I? I've got to start with small pieces of wood. Maybe dried leaves too, something that's going to catch fire really quick. And then when you get something, a fire hot enough, now you're ready to put on your heavy logs. And this is how I view reaching the Jewish people. 1/3 of 1% of the world's population. But if you catch a fire under them and they come to faith, all of the nations of the earth are going to be touched and they are going to be blessed. Remember, the promise to Abraham was to be a blessing to all the families of the earth. I have touched on many things. And I'm confident there are many questions. So I'm going to open up the floor for questions. Don't be fearful. I'm gentle. I don't bite. So please, if there's anyone who has a question.
Maybe I'll be starting for the first question.
Yes.
So you can well understand this. You are like, as the president of this union, like the Pope for us. The Pope is for the Catholics. You are the first between the Jewish believers in Jesus. That's true?
No, it's very different.
It is hundreds of this congregation. How many people is totally in this kind of Jewish believing? And the second question is, what kind of worship of service, like in the Catholics and churches, do you have like the Messianic Jews?
Okay. Yeah, our governmental structure is vastly different. We don't have, let me just put it to you this way. When I chair a meeting, when I conduct a business meeting, I have 24 advisors around the table. All the president does is govern the business meeting and to make sure items on the agenda are covered. The Messianic Jewish Alliance of America, our membership is a little under 20,000. It is not a lot of people at all. It's very, very small. Internationally, it's much smaller. I will have more details when we meet in Berlin in a few days. But our numbers are very, very small. Did I answer everything? I think I'm missing something.
Okay. But about the worship.
Our worship. See, that is a great question. It's very, very difficult. Oftentimes I hear the complaints, we're too Jewish, or we're not Jewish, or we're not Jewish enough. It's difficult to try to please everybody. Our worship is different than mainline synagogues. we incorporate into our worship many Hebrew liturgies, but we also have a time where we sing. And many of our songs are songs that we take from the Psalms. Other songs that we use are songs that some of our people have written, or other people within the Messianic Jewish movement. So we have a time of open praise and worship combined with Hebraic worship. There are times during the year, for example, Passover, and then the High Holy Days, Yom Kippur, where we will observe the Lord's Supper or a communion service. See, in the Jewish world, you know, the observance of communion is much different. Communion means one thing to the Catholic world. In the Jewish world, we call it Kiddush. Kiddush means sanctification, and every Friday evening to welcome in the Sabbath, it is done by the breaking of the bread and the cup of wine. Jesus used these elements because they are elements reminiscent of covenants. Abraham met a man by the name of Melchizedek in Genesis 14. And they made an agreement with one another. And they sealed that agreement, that covenant, by the taking of bread and the cup. It's long been a standing reminder of covenants that God has made. And so Jesus incorporated these very same elements. So this becomes, you know, a part of our worship. But for the most part, our services take on a very strong Hebraic Jewish flavor. Whatever we do in Hebrew, we have English translation. Okay, how often do we meet? We have services on Saturday morning. We have a time of congregational prayer on Tuesday night. We have Bible studies that meet on Wednesday evenings. And we encourage our people to be home to welcome in the Sabbath on Friday evening. We encourage our people to be home observing the Sabbath. Not so much for the, I mean, it is a wonderful way to introduce new people to Messianic Jewish faith. To meet in somebody's home is not as intimidating or fearful than meeting at our house of worship. This gives us a wonderful opportunity for other people to see who we are, what we believe, what we are all about. There's something special about gathering around another individual's table. There is a bonding and a friendship that takes place. And this is how the early church, if you will, grew. When you read in the book of Acts, all of these believers, these followers of Jesus, they broke bread together and went from house to house. So that's what we do. That is our week. And Sunday for me, it's a day of rest.
How does your ceremonies look like?
Okay. I will open up the service, welcome and greet everybody. We will begin with an opening Hebraic prayer, the Matovu prayer. Following the Matovu prayer, we have a short time where we will sing. We'll go into the recitation of the Shema prayer. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Taken from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 through 9. Other Hebraic liturgies. A song service. I will give my message. Then we will maybe have another liturgical piece, and we will close our service. Our service usually lasts about an hour and a half.
Ja mam tylko prośbę, bo problem mają nie tylko Amerykanie, Polacy też. Więc prosiłbym o tłumaczenie księdza. A pytanie jest następujące. Na rynku polskim ukazał się komentarz żydowski do Ksiąg Nowego Testamentu. Wszyscy, którzy z nim się zetknęli, myślę, że doświadczyli tego, jak wielkie jest bogactwo i o wiele głębsze zrozumienie z tekstów Pisma Świętego. To w ogóle wiele osób jest wprost zafascynowanym faktem, że coś takiego się pojawiło, właśnie umożliwiające głębsze zrozumienie. A moje pytanie jest takie, jak w tym układzie Żydzi mesjanistyczni postrzegają tradycję, tą wielowiekową tradycję chrześcijańską i również aktualne nauczanie Kościoła?
Very good question, and thank you. First, it's been my experience that the greatest times of learning come when we are challenged to think outside of the normal bounds. When it comes to various traditions, there are good traditions and there are bad traditions. And that is up for you to decide what traditions are good and bad. There are traditions that Christianity has that are very rich, very meaningful. There are traditions in the Jewish world that are very rich and very meaningful. Again, the question that was asked, I believe, is answered by the wisdom of St. Paul. In Romans, the 14th chapter, he states that, you know, each man, you know, each man observes one day above another, but let him be convinced in his own heart, you know, which one that he will choose. In other words, we have many different traditions, and they're wonderful, but it's up to each and every one of us to determine in our heart which tradition is good and which is bad. Now, when I say tradition, I break up, you know, tradition from that which I believe to be biblical fact. I'll give you an example. Jewish people do not eat pork. This is not a tradition. This is a biblical command that the Jewish people do not eat pork. Walking on the Sabbath or driving a car on the Sabbath or being forbidden to drive on the Sabbath is a tradition. There were no cars in the day of the Bible. But the tradition is that it constitutes work, and so observant Jewish people will not drive on the Sabbath. The Christian world has many, many traditions. And it's up to each and every believer to determine, you know, which tradition is good. I will tell you that it was hurtful to me in the early years of my faith when I was told by some that I should abandon things that are Jewish because now I am a Christian. So conversely, you know, the faith that you have, hold it to your own. Oftentimes in our congregation, because we are a mixed congregation, Not everybody is Jewish. And so non-Jewish members of my congregation, when they first start coming, before they are even members, they want to know, should I celebrate Christmas? And I tell them, if this is what your family is doing, and if this is what you enjoy, celebrate Christmas. So, you know, traditions are beautiful. Traditions keep families together. It keeps cultures together. So I hope I have not over-answered the question. I hope I have answered it to your satisfaction. The president of the Messianic Jewish Alliance of America. There are 20 other international alliances. So the leaders, along with the delegates, are going to be meeting in Berlin just to catch up and, you know, conduct a business meeting. There are many others who will be in that meeting. For example, Eric, my dear friend Eric, will be in that meeting. He is going to attend with observer status. I'm sorry. It's my. What was the second part of the question? Why Berlin? That's a good question. 4 years ago, we met in Jerusalem, and I would have preferred to go back to Jerusalem. But we are meeting in Berlin because the vice president of the International Alliance has a very large congregation in Berlin, and he is doing all of the work and organization work. And so this is why we have selected Berlin. We meet internationally every 4 years. Jerusalem is always my number one priority, but I would be very pleased if in 4 years from now we were in Krakow. One of the great commands is to honor your father and your mother. It's a command that is very, very strong, not just within the Ten Commandments, but all throughout the Bible. When I came to faith, you know, my father was not happy about it. As I said earlier, my father was a Holocaust survivor. In my father's way of thinking, God died at Auschwitz. He lost his entire family. My father did not believe in God, but yet he compelled my brothers and I to remain in the synagogue up to the age of 18. My Jewish friends bowed out of the synagogue after bar mitzvah at age 13. He compelled us to stay right up through 18. And we would always fight with him because we didn't want to go. It meant going to Hebrew school on Wednesday night, services on Saturday, Sunday school. I would rather be playing baseball with my friends. And every time I would argue with my father, and I would say to him, "Why do you force us to go to the synagogue and you never go?" His answer was always the same. "I want you to know who you are and who your people are." And so we go back to tradition. It was very, very painful to tell my father and my mother that I believed in Jesus. Because this would be the ultimate breaking of tradition. And it was a very difficult thing. I didn't want to tell my parents. And I put it off. I didn't want to tell them. But my friend bought me a gift. A friend bought me a gift. It was a Star of David with a cross in the middle of it. So I had that around my neck, and I forgot I was wearing it when I went home, when I went to my parents' home later that night to have dinner with them. And my mother looked at that, and she says, "Frankie, what is that around your neck?" And I'm thinking to myself, this is not going to be good. And I said, "Mom, it's a Star of David." And she says, "I know what that is, but what is that thing in the middle?" And I said, "It's a cross, Mom. I believe that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah." And she began to cry. "Where have I gone wrong with you? What did I do wrong?" And my father put down his fork and he left the table and didn't speak to me for a couple days. And when he broke his silence, he gave me a warning, referring to Christians. He said, "They used to come after us with a stick. Now they're holding out a carrot." You see, for me to believe in Jesus was the height of breaking with tradition. But I'm comforted by the words and the teachings that Jesus gave. Jesus understood that decisions to follow him were going to divide families. He understood and he warned and he taught that for my sake, one may have to leave father and mother. So I broke with the tradition, but I never have and I never would break with the love that I have for my parents. I could tell you more, you know, about my parents of blessed memory. But unlike many cults, see, a cult will always teach you to stay away from your family. But, you know, we love our families and we honor our parents. And so making a good decision, making a good choice regarding the breaking of tradition, you know, it must be based on faith, but we must also do it we have to do it with the fullness of our heart's love. Hurting my parents was the last thing I would ever want to do. But in my heart, I knew who Jesus was, and I could not deny that.
You said that your congregation consists of Jewish people. Is that right?
The congregations of Jewish people.
Yes, that's Messiah.
Yeah, but Messianic
Jewish congregation. Okay. What about Jewish people in Israel? Do they recognize you, and are they against you somehow? Are you persecuted by them?
It's interesting. That's a great question. It used to be, you know, some years ago, where we faced a lot of opposition all across the Israeli society. But things have changed. Our organization, the Messianic Jewish Alliance of America, for example, we bring into the land of Israel up to $20 million and more of $20 million and more of health and humanitarian aid. We have two warehouses in the land of Israel where we receive shipments of all kinds of supplies, medical supplies, refrigerators, hospital beds, you name it. We have two warehouses that store a lot of these valuable materials. And we distribute them all throughout the land. We have made donations to the Israeli Defense Forces. Anytime there is a terrorist act, we are there to hand out goods. So over the years, we have gained a very good reputation in the eyes of Israelis because they see that our motives and our intentions are good, that we identify ourselves as Jews, even if they will not want to recognize us as such. Right now, there's a growing number of the secular Israeli society who are very accepting of us. But there is always going to be opposition from the ultra-Orthodox. In fact, Israeli society, there is civil war because the secular Israeli Jews do not care a lot for the ultra-Orthodox, and the ultra-Orthodox don't think a lot about those who are secular. So we are just another part of this very muddled equation that is the land of Israel.
Frank, thank you very much for your coming, for your lecture, and above for your testimony of your life, for your believing, and for divide this with us. Thank you very much.
Je cuire.
Some words for my students.
We would like to thank you for this wonderful speech you gave us today, and those were truly the words of wisdom and faith. And thank you for them.
Oh, thank you so much. You're all making me turn red in my face. You know that these are going to wind up in the hands of the most beautiful woman in my world, my wife, Margaret. Mark, could you raise your hand so everybody can... All right. She'll be the lady holding the flowers.